Support comes from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Just as no two people are exactly the same, neither are their cancers. At the OSU CCC James, there is no routine cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The period underwear brand Thinx touted its products as alternatives to traditional menstrual products. They described them as organic, non-toxic, and sustainable. Last week, Thinx announced they had settled a class action lawsuit alleging that those products contained harmful chemicals, drawing attention to the larger issue of toxic ingredients in period products. Shara Vosterl is a professor at Purdue. Her 2008 book is titled Under Wraps, A History of Menstrual Hygiene Technology. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
How long has toxicity been an issue in feminine hygiene products?
Well, that's a tough question to answer because it hasn't been a requirement to measure toxicity. In some cases, the science wasn't there. People didn't think to look for it. And then it's not a required element to test for. So if you think about when they were called sanitary napkins back in the 1920s, they were made out of material called cellucotton, which was a cellulose-based product. And there was no testing at that point. So the toxicity, I think there's been much more attention to it from probably the 1970s onward. And of course, the problem of toxic shock syndrome being associated with tampons really sort of opened up that whole can of worms and made people much more aware of risks related to tampons in particular.
I mean, these are things that go into your vagina. It just seems like it's a membrane. It seems like it could be a portal to all sorts of troubles. Do they not regulate these things?
Yes and no. I think our expectations about regulation is much higher than what actually happens at the FDA. In 1976, there was the Medical Device Amendment that was passed. And this was really important because people were getting blinded by contact lenses. They were becoming infertile through things like the Dalkon Shield. Artificial pacemakers were becoming on the market, and people were getting seriously injured because there was no set rule for testing these objects that were meant to improve people's health. So the Medical Device Amendment was passed because the they weren't tested like pharmaceuticals, but the bar is very different for medical devices. The bar is measuring risk versus benefit, not necessarily safety. So that original amendment was really just, it was evaluating claims of accuracy from the manufacturers, not necessarily effectiveness. And that's very different than, is this product safe? Will this product injure me? And if there's always an assumption of risk, then it's a sliding scale. And I think our assumption about the safety and testing it's just very different from what the FDA actually does provide. It's not nothing, but it's not a guarantee.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about regulations or not that revolve around menstrual products, not to treat menstruation, but to manage it. My guest is Shara Vosterl. She is professor at Purdue University. Her 2008 book is titled Under Wraps, A History of Menstrual Hygiene Technology. So how was Thinx able to market its product as a clean alternative if it wasn't? Who's watching what their claims are? They can say anything they want?
This is also part of the trouble of this whole thing. There's the Medical Device Amendment for well, medical devices, there is labeling, which is still part of the FDA, in which, we see labeling requirements on tampon boxes, for example. And then there's advertising. And so each of those areas, consumers can sue for different reasons. And so think has the lawsuits have been about pretty much the way they were advertised, so that the pro they were advertised in a misleading way. And so that is where the lawsuit comes from, not actually the effectiveness of the product itself. And so I think for many folks, thinking you're buying an organic product, you don't expect to have different repellents, absorptive material, I mean, different things like the PFAS in there. And so that's where Thinx is in trouble with its actual advertising. So that's, again, not very satisfying for us as consumers, though, because again, like, we still don't know. We don't know what is in this underwear. And this was supposed to be a better alternative to a disposable product or a tampon that's bleached. And so it's very frustrating, I think, for people who menstruate and trying to figure out what to purchase.
And PFAS, for people who don't know, that's the short no name for these forever chemicals, these plastics that never leave the environment. They just,
Yeah.
they're re just reduced, but they're always there.
They're forever chemicals. They don't break down in the body. They can cause infertility issues. They can cause all sorts of different health-related problems, ovarian disorders, hormonal functions. And of course, it's not an immediate injury, which makes it difficult to measure. It's something that is accumulates over time, and these things are always much more difficult to prove. I mean, we probably could if we did it in a different way, but the results are different for different bodies and different exposures, and it's hard to evaluate in a way that's satisfying all around.
How can a person be sure that they're getting something that's safe for them? Is there any place?
Well, there are some consumer groups that are working very hard to post information about different products. New York is on the cusp and has just passed laws about labeling. That just came into effect in 2023. And New York is a very, it's a big state, it's a powerful state. And so, because those labeling requirements are there for New York, some of the consumer groups are able to find more about the ingredients and the materials that are in the products. California is also set to create a labeling law, which should help. But still, you need to know a lot of chemistry. It's very difficult for just the average person to assess what is the risk of this. And partly, this is just the guidelines have not kept up to the amount of exposure we have to chemicals in society, and what truly is something to be concerned about, and what is something that can be processed by the body. And unfortunately, the regulations need to catch up to both demand and just the hundreds of thousands of things that we're exposed to on a daily basis.
Why do they use all these chemicals in these products? What's the point? Why are they needed?
Yeah. Well, there is a long history of adding perfumes to menstrual pads and to tampons, and that is not necessary at all. Part of it is related to just deep feelings of shame and stigma about being exposed as having a period, about any perception of being stinky or smelly. We have issues with this with body odor, deodorant, all the perfumes we use, the lotions. We do a lot of things to cover up very regular smells of the body. And so adding chemicals to the products is an effort to mask and conceal a very natural process of biodegeneration of blood and mucus and debris, which happens when you have a period. It should break down. That's what it's supposed to do. But that perception and that cultural sort of judgment about it is the problem. So it's sort of a chicken and the egg together. Folks have to be able to be willing to tolerate a little bit more I don't know, messiness, regular smells, and corporations need to not be adding as much to it because there are serious consequences that are really unnecessary for human bodies.
Are women better off today than they were, say, back in the 70s and 80s? Are there more choices out there?
I think there are more choices. I think that, and people are demanding more different types of products. Even over the life course of when you start having a period to when you end having a period during menopause, the blood changes, the viscosity changes, the amount changes, even during within one period. And so it's really difficult to expect one product to satisfy all those different conditions. And then, you know, other groups are sort of pushing back and saying, well, you know, you can free bleed at night when you're asleep. Do you need to have a product in? And, you know, on one hand, that is useful to some people, and other people are like, I'm just going to have a horrible mess if I don't use products at all. And so, there is a practicality, I think. You know, we do like having clean furniture. But at the same time, it's also a very regular, normal, typical thing that we don't need to stigmatize and just add so many prejudices to. And I think we're in the process of challenging that. And that's exactly where this lawsuit comes from, you know, really saying, no, this is not acceptable to have injury related to a product that is supposed to capture blood. This is just not necessary.
There have been great strides in our relationship to the menstrual cycle in recent years. And I'm wondering, since your book was published in 2008, is it time for another chapter?
Oh, it has been such an adventure. I had a very difficult time getting that book off the ground.
Really?
And it's been really wonderful to see, especially this younger generation of writers and journalists come along and activists and really take up the mantle. So, I have been heartened to see the changes and the refusal to be stereotyped and accept the prejudices that people have in the past. So that has been quite nice to see. And then in other countries too, like I've been working with folks in Scotland, and it's a national law that products should be available for free in public places. And this says quite a bit about a country that would provide products to all of its citizens. I mean, you still need to buy them for your own home, but you know, if you're out and about or you're unable to afford them or you're caught, just, you know, you don't always know when your period's going to start, that they say it should be available just like toilet paper or tissue or other things, that's an important thing for citizens. So we do see, there are changes happening. It's just incomplete. And so that's why it sort of pops up in different areas at different times.
Is it because they haven't directly linked illness or any kind of malady to these products that there maybe is this dearth of oversight? I mean, does someone have to die?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, people do have to become pretty ill or pass away for more regulation to happen. And it's the FDA is in a very precarious position because as citizens, we expect protection from the FDA, but the other constituent of the FDA are corporations and companies that their goal is to make money. And we this is how our society is set up. And so how do you deal with those sort of conflicting things? You know, on the one hand, the corporations really don't want to kill folks because then that's bad for business. But at the same time, you want to create a product that's maybe just a little bit different, a little bit more absorptive. And I think this is where things really hit a sweet spot in the market by being underwear instead of a pad with adhesive or a pad, you know, back in the day that had loops. So it was a market opportunity and it was a need, but as consumers, we still want to be safe. You don't want to pull on underwear and suddenly become infertile. That is not a bargain that people are happy to make at all.
What's the most popular technology for menstrual management?
You know, it's changing, and it depends. It depends on your religious perspectives. It depends on your age. Of, sanitary pads, menstrual pads are still very popular. Into the 1980s, tampons were the number one product, with about 70% of women using tampons. I don't have the breakdown of each technology, but menstrual cups are definitely rising in popularity. They really resonate with many menstruators as an environmentally friendly solution, as a way to have a reusable product. And so it just, it depends sort of where your values lie and what resonates with your identity right now. And I think that's the difference, very much so, with products on the market now compared to the 70s or even the 1930s.
I kind of wonder about, we hear about girls starting their menstrual cycles sooner, younger, at a younger and younger age now. And, there's all kinds of, there's reasons for that. But I'm wondering how it affects that market and how it affects, the what kind of, products are going to be coming on the market for them.
Marketing to young first menstruators has been a goal of corporations really since the beginning. There have been menstrual education campaigns about, how to count the number of days between your period and what products to use, and also related to sort of just body physiology and that. So that's been part of the core of menstrual product advertising since the very beginning. I think making them more appealing, a little bit smaller. They used to be all pink. I think it's good that we're moving away from pink into other colors now. But yeah, trying to bring down sort of the heaviness, I think, of menstruation as a loss of childhood. And that's, I think, that menstrual education campaigns are working to address that some more.
Well, Shira, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Shira Vostrel is a professor at Purdue University and author of the 2008 book Under Wraps, A History of Menstrual Hygiene Technology. We've been talking about that because the period underwear brand Thinx announced that they had settled a class action lawsuit alleging that its products contained harmful chemicals, drawing attention to the larger issue of toxic ingredients in period products. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. New year, new diet, or maybe a new detox, one that involves intermittent fasting or a focus on juices or adding or subtracting certain foods. Before you go there, you should be asking yourself some questions. Taylor Grasso is a registered dietitian at the University of Colorado Anschutz. She recently wrote about the science behind detox diets for The Conversation. We'll post a link to that article at wosu.org/allsides. Taylor Grasso, welcome.
Thank you. How are you doing this morning?
Very well, thanks. I'm glad you could join us. What do we mean by detoxing? It's a very familiar term to everybody, but I'm not exactly sure everybody knows what it means.
Yeah, absolutely. So detoxing is really can go in two different directions. So there's things that are detox diets, and that's what a lot of people are often talking about in terms of detoxing. But what a lot of people don't know is that our bodies actually have their own natural built-in detoxification system. And research has really shown that these detox diets and commercial products that are on the market, they really don't enhance our body's natural detoxification system. So what I always try to focus on as a registered dietitian is how we can actually enhance our own detoxification system rather than falling into some of these very attractive quick fixes that are proposed when it comes to detox diets.
What is so if it's our body that can manage this job, what is it doing when it detoxes us?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are some toxins that can enter our bodies. There's internal toxins and then external toxic exposures. So internal toxins are things that are created by our body just during normal metabolism. So things like urea, lactic acid is probably the most familiar to people. You hear that a lot when you're sore, right? So your trainer or personal trainer might say something like, oh yeah, you've got some lactic acid buildup in your muscle. That's why you're sore. That's a really familiar one. And then external toxic exposures are things that can enter our body by either penetration of the skin, through breathing, eating contaminated food or water. It can also be found in things like beauty products. So for example, if there are toxins within our beauty products and then we put them directly on our skin, sometimes they can penetrate that skin barrier and then actually get into our bloodstream. So our natural detoxification system is working to get rid of some of those things that we are exposed to, both internally and then externally as well.
So our body's always doing this anyways, flushing out the bad, keeping the good. And so why this industry that revolves around detoxing then? Where did it come from?
That's a great question. I think that it really just came from diet culture, honestly. You know, the diet industry itself, that I would consider detox supplements to really be a part of that diet industry. As we know, it's like a $7 billion industry, makes a lot of money. And really what detox supplements, I think, are trying to do is perpetuate that quick fix mindset, right? A lot of us, when it comes to nutrition and fitness and those different types of things, it can be really hard to focus on something that's a little bit more sustainable. We like something that happens with the snap of a finger. And detox supplements really provide that. And they say that, you know, they're enhancing your natural detoxification system, when really most supplements, the most that they might do is make you have more bowel movements than frequently, more frequently than you normally would, which really is not fun for you either. So that's really the only way that they could potentially enhance your natural detoxification system. In all reality, what they're really going to be doing is either severely restricting your calories to the point of you feel like you're detoxing in the sense that you're losing quick weight because water weight is coming off really quickly due to that very low calorie restriction, or you're losing a lot in those excess bowel movements. And that's also making you feel like you're losing weight very quickly, but neither of those things are necessarily healthy for you overall. So that's kind of where I feel like it came from, is just the diet industry and promoting kind of that quick fix mindset.
Does anybody, anything oversee this? Is there any oversight?
So the unfortunate thing is not really. Supplements are not regulated by the FDA. So that's the Food and Drug Administration. Our food products and then also pharmaceutical drugs will go through an extensive process to make sure what is on the label is what is actually in the product. Supplements don't actually have to do that. There have been some supplements like fat burners or other detox supplements that have been pulled from the market because there have been claims made against those companies. And then there was more extensive research done. But really, a claim has to be made of some sort, or there has to be an arise of, you know, numerous people suffering from kind of the same side effect for these supplements to really get a good look. There are some supplements that are third-party tested, which means they do get that third eye looking at them. But a lot of the times, these detox and fat burner supplements, those are not going to get a third-party test certification. That's more like protein powders or creatine, things like that. So really, no, there's unfortunately no regulation around it unless claims arise.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with registered dietitian Taylor Grasso about detox diets or detox regimens. It is a new year. They're popular this time of year, so you might want to listen if you're thinking about it. As a registered dietitian, you've seen clients attempt detox diets, even though I'm guessing you said don't do it. They did it anyways and had negative side effects. Like what? Mm-hmm.
So different side effects that can happen are things like headaches, dizziness, fatigue. Like I said, some of those supplements or like enemas and laxatives are actually considered a form of detoxification that some people will do. That poses a really severe risk for dehydration or electrolyte imbalance. And really what a lot of these side effects are coming from is that restriction of calorie or food. And that can cause a lot of those side effects because your body literally runs off of glucose, which is essentially what food or carbohydrates break down into when you consume them. Your brain actually needs 120 grams of glucose per day alone. That's not even to mention what your body needs in order to function optimally. So if you've ever felt like that mid-afternoon brain fog when it's been a little too long since you've had lunch and you're just kind of needing a snack, mm-hmm. that's kind of the initial feelings that you might feel when you first start detoxing because you just have that severe calorie restriction. But those can only get worse as you restrict your calories even more.
Why the headaches? Do you know that?
The headaches just have a lot to do with, you know, actually, that's a great question that I don't think I know the exact answer to, but I just think to the fact of your brain is signaling that it needs glucose. So like I said, your brain functions optimally off of glucose. And if your body doesn't have it, it will find a way to make it. But the unfortunate thing is if it doesn't have it readily available and it has to go and make it, it's really difficult and a hard process for your body. So I'm guessing it's just your body's getting a headache from the headache that it takes to create the glucose. If I had to take an educated guess at that.
What, when we talk about our body's ability to naturally detox, what organs are involved in that?
Yeah. So the liver and the kidneys are the two primary organs. And then a couple of the secondary ones are going to be the skin, the lymphatic system, and then also our GI system and our lungs.
And if somebody has malfunctions when it comes to one of those organs, is there a role for outside external detoxification? Could it be used? Is it ever prescribed?
In my professional opinion, no, it should never really be prescribed. If there are issues with some of those organs, there are different things that you can do. And this is more coming from like an MD standpoint. A doctor would prescribe certain medications or certain procedures. For example, if your kidneys aren't functioning optimally, there's something called dialysis. So you would go in and you would get dialysis where that is stripping out some of those things that your kidneys are not able to filtrate on their own. In my professional opinion, there's really never a time or place to prescribe a detox supplement. Now, there are foods that can naturally enhance some of those detoxification opportunities that our body can do on its own. And the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics recommends certain foods for that. But in any sense, I would never recommend a detox supplement for any reason.
And when we're talking about detox supplements, what do you mean by that? It's not the smoothie necessarily. It's a or some kind of powder you put in the smoothie, right?
So there are detox supplements in the sense of there are pills and other things that you can take and it will promise terms of detoxification. Oftentimes it has a lot of caffeine in it. So that's something that's going to be a stimulant and can decrease appetite and also increase, like I said, that digestive system motility. And then other detoxification systems or programs. So sometimes different companies will run certain types of programs like you're mentioning where there's a shake or a drink or something like that. And that's more promising detoxification in terms of just that calorie restriction. So a lot of programs are on those terms. And there are even some programs that I've heard of where people don't eat food at all. So you think like juice cleanses, for example, where all you're doing is drinking fluids for multiple days and not having any actual solid food. So really, it just kind of depends on the program. I would say fat burner supplements or detoxification supplements that are advertised in that way are kind of ones that you see most often. And then behind that, I would say you see a lot of juice cleanses and things like that too.
What kind of foods are recommended to help our bodies naturally detoxify?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are some gut health promoting foods. That's one of the biggest things. So broccoli and Brussels sprouts are cruciferous vegetables. There's a specific type of fiber that's in there that helps to feed the probiotics or the healthy bacteria that live in our gut. Other ones are garlic, onions, leeks, and then also green tea. So the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics recommends these just because there is some research to back up that they can enhance our liver's natural detoxification. And then another thing to really consider when it comes to food is eating sources of lean protein. So things like poultry, eggs, low-fat dairy. This protein is going to help create glutathione. That's an enzyme that kind of assists your liver and is a master detoxifier. So having a very well-balanced diet and eating some of those foods that I mentioned, and then also having in that lean protein, can be really beneficial to your liver and your natural detoxification system.
There are yogurt ads that claim, you know, they can boost gut health. What do you know about those?
Yeah, so yogurts that are claiming to boost gut health, a lot of times that's coming from the fact that the yogurt is adding some sort of live and active culture. And so a live and active culture means that they are adding in a probiotic. So that's supposed to be helping to increase the diversity of probiotics that live within your gut microbiome. And the reason that we're concerned or care about that is because the more diverse your gut microbiome, the more we're learning about the connection between the brain and the gut, and kind of just the rest of our body really is controlled by how healthy our gut is. So that's why a lot of yogurt ads will promote things like that, because they add in those live and active cultures, and therefore that can potentially promote the growth and development of probiotics.
So diversity is good when it comes to gut health.
Yes, absolutely. Diversity within your diet. So eating a variety of fruits and vegetables, a variety of lean sources of protein. And the reasoning for that is just because all of these foods contain a variety of different vitamins, minerals, prebiotics, things that can help to nurture those probiotics that are already living within your gut. So these are just really good ways to increase that diversity and make sure that you're getting a lot of those things.
Are registered dietitians like you getting enough questions from people about the idea of a detox, an externalized detox, something, you know, outside of their body?
Yeah, so I have to say that I feel like people don't necessarily turn to dietitians if they're planning on doing a detoxification diet, because registered dietitians, you'll notice if you see them on social media or, you know, like me, for example, I really don't promote any sort of quick fix mindset or any sort of quick fix change. We like to really talk about consistent and sustainable healthy habit changes, because that's what's really going to last long term, especially in terms of chronic illness or weight loss. So I would say that unfortunately, most people don't ask dietitians enough questions in terms of these diets. And so if people are out there and they have questions, always go to a dietitian first.
Have you seen examples of people kind of triggering unhealthy gut reactions, kind of doing more harm than good? I mean, it could be benign. Could it also do harm?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, some of these detox programs or claims will have you do things like enemas or laxatives, and that can be incredibly hard on the digestive system and also on your electrolyte and fluid balance, which is in turn hard on your kidneys. And then also just the restriction of calories in general can actually slow down your gut motility. And so there's actually a lot of people out there who suffer with chronic bloating, and that has a lot to do with the fact that they might be under eating, because that just slows down your gastric motility because it's trying to shuttle energy elsewhere because it's not getting enough to maintain those automatic functions that normally happen. So there are definitely some negative side effects on your gut health from doing detoxification diets. And another one that just popped into my head as well is a lot of them contain, like I said, really high amounts of caffeine. And caffeine on an empty stomach can be really, really hard on the gut lining.
Taylor Grasso, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Taylor Grasso. She's a registered dietitian at the University of Colorado Anschutz. She recently wrote about the science behind detox diets for The Conversation. We'll post a link to that at WOSU.org/All Sides. We have more Wellness Wednesday, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. So could Jell-O maybe help fix your tendons? And how can harnessing the power of the mind help your strength training? Alex Hutchinson covers science and fitness for Outside Magazine. He's been looking into these and more issues. Alex Hutchinson, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
A new study suggests that collagen supplements might help repair and strengthen tendons. Could you tell us what collagen is and tell us about the study?
Yeah. So, I mean, collagen is the main building block of all the connective tissue in your body, or most of the connective tissue in your body. So we're talking tendons and ligaments and bones. And the main thing to know about it is that it's very hard to repair. So if you look at the tendons of a 40-year-old, what you'll find is that they look very much like the tendons that they had when they were 18, or at least when you're 18 years old, you have tendons and you have bones and you have ligaments, and that's what you've got for the most part. There's been some fascinating studies looking at fallout from nuclear bomb testing in the 50s. And so you can look at cadavers and you can trace the amount of radioactivity in the tendons or in the bones. And this confirms that it's like when you're forming new tendons, you are incorporating the stuff that's around in the atmosphere, like the radioactivity from the nuclear tests into your tendons. And anyway, what this shows is that you really don't do much repairing of your connective tissue of this collagen once you become an adult. And so this is why when people have tendon problems, for example, if they have Achilles tendonitis, it's really hard to repair, because it's not like a cut on your skin, which gets repaired in days, or even a muscle tear, which might get repaired in weeks. Tendons are very hard to repair. So for the last couple of years, let's say starting in about 2017 or 2018, there's been a line of research suggesting that actually there are ways of triggering quicker repair and strengthening of connective tissues like tendons and ligaments. And the secret seems to be Jell-O, essentially.
Yeah, Jell-O. How so?
Yeah, well, so Jell-O is essentially a processed form of collagen. You make Jell-O by like boiling horse's bones or whatever. You know, I'm not an expert on Jell-O manufacture, but that was the traditional way of making gelatin. And so if you take, I don't want to be gross here, but if you chop up a tendon and eat it, you're not going to be able to make use of it. It's just going to pass through your digestive system. So collagen has to be processed in a way that you can get at the raw building blocks, the amino acids that make up collagen. So Jell-O turns out to be a surprisingly effective way of taking in collagen in a form that you can use it. Now, there are other ways. The other big way is something called hydrolyzed collagen, which is the form that a lot of collagen supplements come in now, which again is just like gelatin, just like Jell-O, is basically a form of collagen that's broken down in a form that your body can then transport it to areas that you need it. But as this trend kind of caught on in the last few years, you'd see things like elite athletes on Instagram posting their Jell-O recipes, saying, this is what I do every day before workout, is I take this, raspberry Jell-O with some blueberries, because you have to take vitamin C with the gelatin in order to for your body to use it properly. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of hype in the last 2 or 3 years. And what's new is, the idea makes sense, that you're trying to repair these connective tissues, which are mostly made of collagen. You give it more of the building blocks of collagen, but does it work in the real world? And that's right. What we've been kind of waiting to find out. And so just in the last week, there's an interesting study done with elite female soccer players in Britain that randomized half of them to get collagen supplements and half of them not. And over 10 weeks, what they found is there was a really substantial difference in tendon stiffness at the end of the 10 weeks. And stiffness is a good thing for tendons. Tendons are like elastic bands. You want them to be, when you pull on them, to resist. And so they store a lot of energy and they're stronger. And so there was a very positive improvement in this study. which is, I would say, one of three studies in the last year or two that have started to build some evidence to say that actually this approach of taking either Jell-O or collagen supplements in combined with workouts might well allow people to either repair or strengthen their tendons and ligaments.
People who don't like Jell-O are crazy, but some people don't like Jell-O, and they can take collagen supplements instead.
Yeah. In fact, the caveat I should add is that if you want to do it with Jell-O, you really have to like Jell-O, because you have to take fairly substantial amounts of collagen. I'm trying to remember I think the dose was something like 30 grams of collagen. Yeah, it was 30 grams of collagen. So I don't remember how many packages of Jell-O that translates to, but let's say quite a bit. So the alternative is you can get food grade gelatin, unflavored, so that you can mix this in. Basically, you make it into a kind of drink that you just sort of shoot down, or with the collagen supplements.
Like a smoothie, just throw it in your smoothies.
Yeah, so it's no longer, Jell-O is pleasurable, I agree with you. The supplements, you're not doing it for pleasure, you're doing it because you want your tendon to work again or to stop bothering you.
How do they know that a tendon's better after that 10 weeks? What did they measure?
It's a really, really difficult question, and each study does it differently. There was a case study published a few years ago with an NBA basketball player who'd had patellar tendonitis ever since he was a teenager. And they implemented this protocol of gelatin and specific exercises. And eventually what they did is they took MRIs of the tendon and sent them to orthopedic surgeons who were blinded, who didn't know which MRI they were looking at, whether it was before or after. And they would say, that tendon looks a lot healthier. We can see the structure is not frayed. We can see that the lines of collagen line up the way they should, as opposed to, like, it's scar tissue, you get these lines of collagen that are sort of all over the place pointing in different directions. So you can, with an MRI, you can see very specifically what the structure of the tendon is. For some of these other studies, they're using more indirect methods, basically like ultrasound to see the length of the tendon, and then they're looking at how much force the tendon can take in doing strength exercises, and then from that you can calculate, well, how much force did they have on it and how much did the length change when we applied force.
I mean, I assume if they're studying elite soccer players in England, these are younger people, younger women. What does this suggest for older people who are really dealing with the ravages of time? Does it help to start at any age?
Yeah. I mean, look, unfortunately, the answer to that question is, I'm not sure. I think it's those of us like myself who are well past the first bloom of youth who can benefit the most. Look, when you're 18, you can build tendon, you're still building tendons. And these soccer players were, in fact, on an average 17. When you're older, it's when you're in that sort of, the tendons are just getting, it's a one-way street for the tendons. That is when you'd hope it would work. There's no reason to think it won't work. It's probable that it won't work as well. Nothing works as well when you're my age as it did when you were 18. But there's no theoretical reason that it wouldn't. Maybe it's not going to make you, increase the stiffness of your tendons by 20%, but maybe it's going to stop the decline, which otherwise is kind of going on with every passing minute.
Let's shift gears here a sec. Military researchers recently assessed the future of strength training. And one of the areas they identified that has interesting recent research was harnessing the mind. First of all, define strength training, what we mean by that, and tell us about the mind-body relationship there.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is getting stronger and lifting heavy things to get stronger. This was a review of kind of where strength training goes from here by military researchers. And what was kind of reassuring to me is they started out with saying, well, what do we know about how you get stronger? Well, you lift heavy things, then you put them down, and then you do it again. And all the, you can read 10,000 magazines on the nuances of that. But fundamentally, if you're focusing on strength rather than, say, bigger muscles, then you're going to lift heavy weights. Let's say a weight you might be able to lift 5 or 6 times. You might do it 3 sets. You might do it 2. You might do it 4. But actually, you don't really need to worry about it. The details of how to lift weights or do strength training, resistance exercises, are fairly simple. But so what they wanted to ask is, what can we do that would take us to the next level? And one of the, they had a few different ideas, but one of the ones that caught my eye was this the link to the mental side of strength training. And they pointed out there was this fascinating lockdown study with a professional basketball team in Scotland. The lockdown hit in 2020, and they were all basically confined to their apartments with no training equipment. So they took advantage of it and they said, okay, half of you are going to do 3 times a week, a really hard strength training program. You're going to do, you know, 8 exercises, upper body, lower body, 3 sets of each, 60% of one rep max, but it's going to be all imaginary. You don't actually have any weights. You're going to sit there and you're going to go through this entire workout, imagining that you're lifting a weight and putting it down and feeling tired and all this stuff. And the other group's going to do nothing. And amazingly, I kid you not, at the end of, I can't remember if it was 6 or 8 weeks or something like that, the group that had done these very hard, very detailed imaginary workouts with imaginary weights had gained substantial strength, and the control group hadn't.
How are they very hard but imaginary?
Well, it's mental focus requires effort, right? So it's one thing to say, I'm imagining that I'm lifting 1 billion pounds. It's another thing to imagine that 50 pounds is right in front of you. It's on the floor and you're going to have to bend down and you're going to pick it up and you're going to feel, you know, the bringing to bear your focus and your imagination is what requires you then, you're actually getting your motor cortex to send the signal to your muscles, even though you're not actually then contracting the muscles. And that's what's allowing the gains to happen, is that you're optimizing, you know, if you want to lift something, if you have to, your brain has to tell your muscles to contract, and you don't just have one arm muscle, right? You've got these thousands and thousands of individual fibers that have to contract in a specific pattern. So by imagining it, you're helping to optimize the way the signal travels, how fast it travels, how coordinated the command to contract is. And so that seems to help even in the absence of actually lifting anything.
I mean, how far could they take this? Do they know?
I think there are limits. I imagine, you know, I mean, these were professional athletes. These were people who were already fit, and they gained, I can't remember if it was, you know, in the 6 to 10% range in strength. So it's not nothing. Like,
yeah.
It is a real gain. Yeah. I take anything that's in the positive numbers.
Right.
What they go on, you know, where they take this is not, we're going to move to a future of imaginary training for everybody, because then we don't have to spend money on weights. The broader point is, first of all, you can use it in a rehab context. Let's say you've injured your right arm. You're going to do, there's evidence that training your right arm improves your left arm strength a little bit, less than it does the right arm, but because some of the brain pathways are the same. So what they're saying is the whole imaginary concept can be useful if you're stuck in bed in hospital. You've just had a knee replacement. You don't want to be completely withered away when you get out. Well, you should do some workouts while you're lying in your bed, even if they're imaginary.
And when
beyond
you,
that,
well, no, that's okay. We're just about out of time, and I'm curious, when you say they're very hard workouts, they're complicated. I mean, so you got to, like, are you lifting your arms or just totally in your brain thinking about this?
It's totally in your brain. And wow. So this is where you can apply it to a regular workout. That when you are actually lifting a weight, the point is, be there. Don't be thinking about what you're having for dinner. Be thinking about putting everything you have into lifting that weight, because that's the, and there are studies again that find that the difference between lifting a weight and lifting a weight while imagining that it's even heavier than it is, so that you're trying harder for the same weight, that produces greater gains too. So it's a broader argument, I think, that applies to life, which is that if you're focused and you're there and you're giving your all, you're going to get more out of it.
So when my trainer says to up my weight, when I do my, you know, whatever the piece of workout is, I can just say, no, I'm just going to imagine it.
Yeah, you can say, trust me, I just tripled the weight mentally, so I don't actually need to put another plate on.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Alex Hutchinson, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Anne. It's always fun to talk.
Alex Hutchinson covers science and fitness for Outside Magazine. We'll have a link to his latest at WOSU.org/AllSides. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.